Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and I'm your host. You can find out more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Hi, everybody. I have been taking care of my mother, who has been here in California for the last 2 weeks, and I haven't been able to focus on anything else. It has been 2 weeks of many emotions, and mom is ready to go home. The good news is she's doing much better than we thought, and I will be going back to New Jersey in a week to start helping her officially move into her partner's place. She's been unofficially living with him for the last several months, and it's just time to make it official since we don't think it makes sense for We don't think it makes sense to keep her condo because we don't think it's safe for her to live alone anymore. And she has come to terms with it as well. So it's the best of circumstances that we could hope for in that we feel that she belongs in New Jersey with her boyfriend. And I'll just be making more visits back there. But it's really, really good news. So all that's to say, regretfully, I did not have time to write the next podcast episode, but I still wanted to give you some content to enjoy and ponder and chew on and hopefully comment on. So I decided to just put together a compilation of all the radio commentaries I have done for National Public Radio, specifically KQED, my National Public Radio station in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's 11 years of episodes. I've kind of pulled out the ones I think you would enjoy most. They're each only 2 minutes long, so they're pretty short, and I thought it would be fun for you to listen to them back to back if you haven't listened to them already. All of the transcripts and the individual episodes themselves are at joyfulvegan.com and kqed.org. Please note that all of these recordings were produced by KQED Radio, and they own the rights to each one of them, and I'm sharing them with their permission. I hope you enjoy them, and remember, please visit joyfulvegan.com if you're able to support this podcast at any amount. Your support makes it possible for me to produce these podcasts. We have no sponsors right now other than listeners at this point, so these podcast episodes are literally 100% listener supported, and I thank you for your support. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thank you for listening and enjoy. This first one that you're going to hear was my very first perspective at KQED Radio, and it's called A Turkey's Dream Thanksgiving. Humans are funny birds. We get so wrapped up in habits, comfort zones, and traditions that sometimes it takes a lot of strength and courage to step back and question who we are and what we do. Thanksgiving is one such instance, sadly exemplified by the alternative name for the day, Turkey Day. Thanksgiving is meant to be a day when we celebrate the bounty of the harvest, pause in gratitude for the abundance most of us experience, and share what we have with others. Most people don't stop to think about the near 300 million birds who are killed each year in the United States just to satisfy our taste buds. Of this number, 45 million are killed for Thanksgiving alone. As someone who eats no animal flesh or secretions and writes vegan cookbooks and vegan lifestyle books, I have seen many people switch to plant-based eating and enjoy an abundance of delicious, nutritious food. I also know that it takes a real shift in perception to shed the comfort zones of the past and create new ones. Some people have a real fear that they will no longer have satisfying, filling meals, especially on Thanksgiving. I can say with confidence that they can put their fears to rest. Our Thanksgiving feast every year is full of comfort foods galore: mashed potatoes with gravy, stuffing, mashed rutabagas, cranberry relish, stuffed squash, cornbread, Brussels sprouts, corn, peas, pumpkin pie with non-dairy whipped cream, apple pie. This was our menu last year, and I'm sure I've left something out. Indeed, there is no dearth of food on our table. And for those who need that dose of familiarity, tofu turkey is always another option. For those who don't know, turkeys are magnificent animals, full of spunk and spark and affection. I was amazed the first time I visited rescued turkeys at a local farm animal sanctuary, birds who had been abused, whose beaks and toes had been mutilated, but who still displayed immense affection for humans. One turkey climbed into my lap and cooed as she fell asleep in my arms while I stroked her soft chest and beautiful feathers. Start a new tradition this year. Try a turkey-free Thanksgiving. It will be a happy turkey day indeed. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. This next episode is called Vegetarians Arise. And by the way, I did not choose the titles for these episodes. That was KQED. An unwritten social rule says that vegetarians must always be considerate, respectful, and sensitive to meat eaters. They must not speak of their reasons for being vegetarian, but when asked, they must make their answers brief and sanitized to not upset the meat eater. The stereotype that vegetarians talk about being vegetarian all the time is, well, true, but only because once a meat eater learns you're vegetarian, you become their confessor, counselor, and sounding board. You can't stop them. Unsolicited, they proceed to tell you how often they eat meat, or how they've become vegetarian except for the chickens and fish they still consume. Or they challenge you with nonsensical justifications for eating animals, like it's actually humane to eat them, because if everyone went vegetarian, what would we do with all those animals? Having been indoctrinated into eating meat as a child, I understand how powerfully ingrained this habit is, but I do wish the respectful attitude expected of vegetarians were a two-way street. Every vegetarian I know treads ever so gently in the speciesist realm in which we live. That doesn't mean we don't challenge the status quo through outreach, education, etc., but it does mean we tend to be sensitive and polite. Vegetarians avoid asking meat eaters why they eat animals or where they get their vitamin C, fiber, and antioxidants, nutrients people are genuinely deficient in, unlike the great protein deficiency myth that vegetarians are forever doomed to debunk. What the public doesn't realize is every time a vegetarian is silenced, challenged, or ridiculed, another heart stops beating. 10 billion land animals are bred every year in the U.S. only to be killed for nothing, for appetite. Honestly, I can cope with the lack of respect for my choices because I know it has nothing to do with me. I'm just the vegetarian in the room who reflects the misery, pain, and suffering of every life that's cut short by a steel blade. So I will continue to be respectful, considerate, and sensitive. I have to be. 10 billion lives are at stake. With a perspective, I'm Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
Now, I didn't include every KQED perspective here because the sound quality isn't great on some of them, but you can find them all at joyfulvegan.com. This next episode is called Compassion on a Plate.
I have yet to meet a non-vegetarian who doesn't care about the treatment of animals raised and killed for human consumption. Even people who eat meat, aware on some level that the experience is unpleasant for the animals, will tell you that they object to unnecessary abuse and cruelty. They declare that they buy only humane meat, free-range eggs, and organic milk, perceiving themselves as ethical consumers, and these products as the final frontier in the fight against animal cruelty. Though modern animal factories look nothing like what's idealized in children's books and advertisements, there are also many misconceptions about humane farms, where animals are ostensibly raised as pampered pets who are killed. The process of turning live animals into isolated body parts begins at birth and ends in youth, as the animals are all young when they're sent to slaughter, whether they're raised for their flesh, eggs, or milk, raised conventionally or in operations labeled sustainable, natural, free-range, grass-fed, or organic. The movement toward humanely raised animals simply assuages our guilt more than it actually helps the animals. If we truly want our actions to reflect the compassion we say we have, then it's very simple. We can stop eating them. How can this possibly be considered anything but a rational and merciful response to a violent ritual? Every animal born into this world has the same desire for maternal comfort and protection, the same ability to feel pain, and the same impulse to live as our beloved dogs and cats. The slaughtering of an animal is a bloody act, and death does not come easy for those who want to live. Clearly, we can survive and, in fact, thrive on a plant-based diet. What does it say about us that when given the opportunity to prevent violence, we choose to turn away because of tradition, habit, convenience, or pleasure? However much we romanticize it, and no matter how we package it, killing animals unnecessarily is anything but humane. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
This episode is called The Lives of Others.
I admit to being one of those people who can't resist greeting every animal I encounter. My husband has accepted that our evening walks are often interrupted by my need to pet every dog being walked and every cat lounging on the sidewalk. I've also been known to bring animals home with us, dogs who are clearly lost, cats who are clearly homeless. I don't seek out wandering dogs or hungry-looking cats, but they seem to find me. And at that moment when I realize I have to intervene, my first thought is always, oh no, I'm in a rush, I don't have time, this isn't my problem. But that voice is never loud enough to make me turn away.
It would be easier to do, certainly more convenient, especially for my own two cats who have to relinquish a part of their living space for whatever refugee happens to come home with us. But if it's not my problem, then whose is it? By virtue of being part of a larger community, I can't help but feel a responsibility to care for all its members, particularly those who are the most vulnerable. Gandhi once said, "The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated." By that definition, we have a long way to go, but there's so much we can do to make sure that no one suffers needlessly. I keep leashes, treats, and blankets in my car and have the number for my local animal shelter stored in my cell phone. I support spay-neuter clinics, and I've pulled over many times to move a lifeless body out of the street, calling when there's a telephone number on the tag and creating a proper burial when there's not. Basically, I've come to accept that whatever plans I have on any given day may be curtailed by an unexpected critter who happens to cross my path. These small steps reap huge rewards, namely reuniting animals with their people, providing shelter to the lost and abandoned, and just knowing that a few moments of inconvenience for me makes a world of difference in the lives of others. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. This episode is called Food Rainbow. As an educator around the ethics of food, my message for eating compassionately is simple. Make choices that reflect your own values of compassion and kindness. When it comes to eating healthfully, my message is equally simple. Eat by color. After all, the greatest number of healthful compounds can be found in the most colorful foods. The pigments that give fruits, vegetables, and flowers their distinctive hues are called phytochemicals, and we can detect the highest concentration of the different phytochemicals just by looking at their color. Anthocyanins that make blueberries blue, beta-carotene that makes carrots orange, folate that makes kale green, lutein that makes corn yellow. More than 900 different phytochemicals have been identified, and hundreds more are still undiscovered. Although phytochemicals are not technically classified as nutrients, they've been identified as containing properties such as antioxidants that appear to play a role in disease prevention and treatment, particularly those related to cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And remember, there are no naturally occurring phytochemicals in meat, fish, dairy, or eggs. Phyto, after all, means plant. It's only when animals eat plants that they take in these and other nutrients. Cattle get calcium and protein from the grass and foliage they eat. Salmon turn pink from the plant-eating animals they eat. And egg yolks turn yellow from the lutein-rich plants the chickens eat and from the synthetic lutein added to their feed. By going directly to the plants, we skip the unnecessary and unhealthful animal-based saturated fat, animal protein, lactose, and dietary cholesterol, all of which work against the benefits of the fiber, phytochemicals, vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants prevalent and inherent in plants. By painting our diets with a rainbow palette of plant foods, including black mushrooms, beige nuts and seeds, white garlic, brown grains, we're guaranteed to be eating the most nutrient-rich, flavor-dense, aesthetically pleasing, humane diet possible. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. This episode was called Urban Livestock. With access to healthful fruits and vegetables lacking in many areas of Oakland, the city's modifying its zoning regulations to make it easier for people to grow and sell edible plants. As an urban gardener in Oakland, I support these changes 110%. The problem is that some are also pushing the city to allow for animal farming and slaughter, and some people have already begun killing animals illegally. As the national movement towards urban agriculture gains traction, many city administrators are in favor of backyard plant-based agriculture, but against its animal-based counterpart because of concerns about public health, animal welfare, and the financial burden it places on already overtaxed city budgets. To keep costs down, many people keep animals in unsanitary conditions and provide minimal to no veterinary care, which increases suffering, odors, predators, and disease, making it an issue not only of animal welfare, but also of public nuisance and public health. Oakland's underfunded shelter, animal control officers, shelter staff, and volunteers are already overburdened with cases of abuse, neglect, abandonment, and overpopulation of dogs, cats, and pet rabbits. More animals means more neglect, abuse, and abandonment, and no funds for enforcement, investigation, rescue, and treatment. Because of this urban livestock trend, animal rescue organizations and shelters have already seen an increase in the number of abandoned animals, including hens, roosters, rabbits, and goats. Complaints from neighbors will most certainly rise, particularly as homeowners have to endure the squeals of an animal being killed just a few feet from their home by a do-it-yourself slaughter hobbyist. With many Oakland citizens already struggling with health problems that even the Alameda County Public Health Department recognizes as being diet-related, the city has a responsibility to advocate the consumption of healthful plant foods, not more animal products. Together, we can create an equitable, sustainable food system in our beloved Oakland, but one based on life-giving rather than life-threatening foods. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. This episode was simply called Slaughterhouse, and I co-wrote this particular editorial with writer James McWilliams. Last month, an employee at a Fresno slaughterhouse shot four co-workers and attempted to take his own life. The president of the slaughterhouse declared the incident to be a random act. But was it? There's no way to prove conclusively that slaughterhouse work caused this assault, but I think it's worth examining whether this man's decision to kill humans in a setting where thousands of animals are killed daily was more than coincidental. As a society, we have a paradoxical relationship with animals. We agree that killing a dog or a cat is an act of violence, but we rationalize the annual slaughter of 10 billion birds, pigs, and cows because it's socially acceptable. But socially sanctioned violence is still violence, and the violence inherent in killing animals has undeniable psychological consequences. There's much research to be done in this field, but the theory is not new. The Sinclair hypothesis, which posits that the propensity for violent crime is increased by work that involves the routine slaughter of animals, is named after the author of the provocative 1906 novel, The Jungle. But writers, philosophers, and humanists have been making the connection between animal abuse and violent crime for centuries. However, we need look no further than the slaughterhouse workers themselves and what they say about their daily roles as knockers, shacklers, stickers, and gutters is sobering. Pressured to meet killing quotas or lose their jobs, employees routinely vent their frustrations by torturing the animals. Videos reveal workers ripping the heads off of chickens, playing football with live turkeys, and poking pigs and cattle in sensitive areas with electric prods. Such revelations, along with data collected and examined by sociologists and psychologists, suggest that a cold mentality toward animal life might in turn cheapen regard for human life. Provided what we know about the social, psychological connections between animal abuse and human violence, I think we need to take seriously the possibility that systematic violence against animals can lead to random violence against humans. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
This perspective was called Hearts versus Taste Buds.
On the basis of compassion and good sense, the California state legislature made it illegal to sell foie gras as of July 2012. The production of foie gras necessarily involves the force feeding of ducks and geese, resulting in a diseased and painfully enlarged liver for which the animals are eventually killed, all for a cracker spread. In 2011, the California state legislature made it illegal to sell shark fins. The ban became effective as of July 1, 2013. To keep restaurants in supply, sharks, as many as 70 million a year, are caught, have their fins sliced off, and are thrown back into the ocean to slowly die, gravely affecting not only those individuals, but the larger ecosystem and the population of dozens of shark species, all for a soup ingredient. Since the foie gras ban went into effect, most restaurants have taken it off their menus, but some have been either overtly selling it or covertly offering it to knowing customers as a secret menu item. Some restaurant owners are delighting in the creative ways they're exploiting a loophole in the foie gras ban that makes it illegal only to sell it, so they're giving it away for free to patrons. We have yet to see if opponents of the shark fin ban will do the same, but as in the final legal days of foie gras, people were urged to order shark fins before they went underground. Personally, I see no difference between killing a duck for his liver, a shark for his fins, a chicken for her wings, an elephant for her tusks, or a rhino for his horn. Cultural prerogative and personal choice, the common refrain of those who defend such acts, are feeble excuses for what amounts to desire, profit, and pleasure. I take heart in every anti-cruelty law we pass and find hope in each person who advocates for those who have no voice. They remind me that aside from a few antagonists, our hearts are larger than our taste buds. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
The opinions expressed in the Perspective series are those of the commentators and not necessarily those of its funder or KQED Public Radio.
Just a little reminder there. It's helpful for me to do that for KQED. This next one is called Coming Home, and it really doesn't have much to do with animals, but it gives you a little taste of my perspective and my life.
I grew up in a suburban town in New Jersey on a street that dead-ended in a forest of trees. The houses were modest but sat on relatively large plots of land that spilled into one another, no fences to define boundaries. My best friend and my first kiss lived in the house behind ours, and we, along with all the children in the neighborhood, would play together outside for hours. Summers consisted of three-legged races, block parties, and running through the sprinklers. We had Easter egg hunts in the spring, built snow forts in the winter, and delighted in the autumn ritual of jumping into huge piles of fallen leaves. Until recently, I had forgotten all of this. The dominant narrative of my childhood memories became the divorce, the custody battle, and the pain of leaving my home, my friends, and especially my dog. Over time, fantasies displaced my memories as I imagined living in a close-knit community, romanticizing what I imagined small-town life to be like, and tearfully watching reruns of Little House on the Prairie and recently BBC's Lark Rise to Candleford, both of which depict idyllic 19th-century rural towns where neighbors know each other by name, share meals together, and look out for one another. In other words, my dream. Recently, my husband and I moved into a new neighborhood and learned very quickly how special it is. We didn't buy the house knowing there were weekly happy hours in the summer, cookie exchange parties around the holidays, and spontaneous gatherings in front of each other's houses as a matter of course. But here I was, here I am, living a real-life version of what I thought was possible only in my imagination or in fiction. And then I remembered the neighborhood of my childhood. I realized that all these years I wasn't trying to capture something I hadn't experienced before. I was trying to return to something I had loved. I created my past through selective memory, but now I get to have the best of all worlds, the fantasy, the memory, and the reality. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
This perspective won't surprise many of you. You've heard this before, but it was good to do it for KQED Radio. It's called Meat, Milk, and Butter for Vegans.
I've been vegan for 15 years, and I've been eating meat the entire time. I've also been drinking milk and baking with butter. Not mock meat, not fake butter, not imitation milk. I eat real food based on real ingredients. I don't consume substitutes, alternatives, analogs, or replacements. I grew up conditioned to believe that animal-based meat, dairy, and eggs are the barometers by which all other comestibles should be measured. Thus, we're told, anything that doesn't come off of or out of an animal is considered an alternative. The marketing arms of the meat, dairy, and egg industries have no doubt shaped our thinking in this area. The National Milk Producers Federation has been trying for years to forbid plant-based milk companies from using the word milk, claiming they have proprietary ownership of that word. Try telling a lactating mother it's called breast beverage. Hence, I drink milk. Although water is the only beverage for which we have a physiological need beyond our own human milk when we're young, it's certainly convenient and tasty to be able to make creamy, nutrient-rich milk from nuts, grains, legumes, and seeds. No cholesterol, no lactose, no casein, no harmful saturated fat, no pregnant female who will subsequently lose her offspring as well as her life. I also eat butter, which has more to do with fat than animal fluids, as in peanut butter or cocoa butter. These butters are simply made from the fat of plants rather than that of animals. I even eat meat, which comes from the Old English word meta, which originally referred to solid food rather than a beverage. This history is still evident in our language when we say coconut meat or the meat of a nut. And it is in that vein that I embrace and consume meat made from plants. Far from fake, these foods reside in the major plant kingdoms from which we derive much of our pleasure and most of our nutrition. In using words that celebrate the plant foods of the world, we normalize the healthful, humane way of eating called vegan. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
The opinions expressed in the Perspective series are those of the commentators and not necessarily those of its funder or KQED Public Radio.
Was happy to do another perspective about turkeys around Thanksgiving time, and so this one is called Thanksgiving Without the Turkey.
The gathering of 52 English colonists and 90 Wampanoag Indians in 1621 marked the beginning of what we call Thanksgiving today. After enduring a year of starvation and disease, for the Christians, it was a time to praise God for the abundance of the harvest. For the Native Americans, it was a time to praise the earth for the same. For me, 400 years later, not much is different. Community, gratitude, and seasonal crops dominate my thoughts, though I have to work hard to drown out the constant talk of baked turkeys, roasted turkeys, and turkey pot pies. You see, I've been celebrating a vegetarian Thanksgiving for 23 years and a vegan one for 16, and deciding what to serve each year is the most difficult part, not because of the lack of options, but precisely because there are so many. When people think of a vegan Thanksgiving, I think they envision something lacking, because we're all taught that a proper main dish comprises some type of animal flesh. But really, I think what matters most is having a beautiful centerpiece on the table and a focal point on the plate. And one of the best ways to accomplish this is through things that can be stuffed, such as winter squash, little pumpkins, eggplants, tomatoes, peppers, mushrooms, or corn husks. Even before I stopped eating animals, for me, Thanksgiving dinner was always about the side dishes. Mashed potatoes, rutabagas, mushroom gravy, bread stuffing, cranberry relish, fresh corn, green beans, roasted vegetables, cornbread, homemade biscuits, and green salad. Dessert options include pies, cakes, cobblers, cookies, and crisps. And with just a few switcheroos, vegetable broth, plant-based milks, and non-dairy butters, our Thanksgiving feast is as traditional as it is beautiful. Despite murmurings that it's not a traditional Thanksgiving dinner without the turkey, the truth is we all shape our traditions out of our values, and we don't have to choose one over the other. We can enjoy food-based rituals that don't involve sacrificing taste, familiarity, a sense of community, or an animal. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
I think I've come to realize that's Wampanoag, but forgive me my mispronunciation. This next one is also not really about animals, but I hope you'll appreciate it. And this is especially poignant for me, given my mother being here right now in the state that she's in. It is called The Problem with Mom Isn't Mom.
My relationship with my mother was always a struggle. Each of us had expectations of the other that neither could possibly meet, and for decades we rode a roller coaster of hope, frustration, and disappointment. During one of the worst of those times, someone close to me observed that my mother and I clearly loved each other very much. I was incredulous. I had just described yet again how misunderstood and hurt and unmothered I felt. How could that possibly be translated into love? "Because neither of you give up," my friend said. "Despite how much you struggle, you keep going back. If you didn't care, you wouldn't even try." It took 20 years for that to really sink in, but it was a strange comfort whenever I was upset with my mother. Anger, after all, was better than indifference. There was a time when one of my greatest fears was that my mother would die before I resolved my issues with her, leaving me with regret and remorse. Of course, perceiving her as the problem that needed fixing, I suppose I figured that resolution would come in the form of her miraculously becoming the mother I needed her to be. Not surprisingly, that never happened, but something better did. I came to realize that the problems in our relationship had nothing to do with her and everything to do with my expectations of her. And so I decided to stop expecting her to be the mother I wanted her to be and decided instead to be the daughter I wanted to be, the daughter I could be proud of. Rather than lamenting about what I wasn't getting from her, I started giving those things to her. And remarkably, the resolution came. With all of my expectations stripped away, all that's left is that love my friend perceived so many years ago. A couple years ago, my mother suffered a mini stroke, and some of her speech and memory has been impaired. She often struggles to articulate what she wants to say, and dementia can sometimes make her confused. But ironically, our communication is better than ever, and she has no problem understanding me when I tell her I love her, and has no problem telling me back. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
If you haven't heard this one, it's a good one to play around Valentine's Day. It's called Love Food.
For thousands of years, many plant foods have been eaten for their aphrodisiac qualities, inspired by their sensory characteristics, or even by their internal effects. Some of the effects are strictly visual. The color red, for instance, has always been associated with passion and can be found on Valentine's Day menus in the form of beets, cherries, and cranberries. The sensual pomegranate has long symbolized fertility, and the asparagus has been enjoyed as an aphrodisiac because of its shape. Some aphrodisiacs are considered such because of their texture. Agave nectar, derived from a cactus-like plant, oozes a thick, sweet syrup.
The romantic effect of champagne has more to do with the bubbles than with the alcohol. And apricots, mangoes, peaches, and tomatoes, also known as love apples, are on the list of sensual foods primarily for their built-in succulents. Many foods cause real physical changes in the body, both positive and negative, making them either ideal for a romantic meal or destined to douse the fire. Choosing foods that keep the blood flowing to all of our organs is optimum, and plant foods do this in spades, some more than others, such as hot peppers and garlic. Meat and animal products, on the other hand, constrict the blood vessels, decreasing blood flow and thus potentially decreasing the libido. Turning up the heat, both in terms of temperature and spiciness, can have a powerful effect. My favorite romantic after-dinner elixir is Mexican hot chocolate, which entails adding chili powder to hot cocoa or melting chili-laced chocolate bars in almond milk. The idea is to excite, not overload or dull the senses. Overeating and excessive alcohol may leave you lethargic rather than libidinous, and even the most sensuous food or beverage can backfire in excess. To paraphrase Shakespeare, it may provoke and unprovoke. It may provoke the desire, but take away the performance. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
The opinions expressed in the perspective series are those of the commentators and not necessarily those of its funder or KQED Public Radio. Local underwriting is provided by Leif Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, with offices nationwide, including San Francisco and New York. Leif Cabraser represents plaintiffs in personal injury, defective products, consumer and employment cases. On the internet at lchb.com.
And finally, this is the most recent perspective I have. It is called Animal Abuse Then and Now.
On a recent trip to Italy while touring the baths of Pompeii, a woman in my group looked up at a graphic depiction of a boy swimming with dolphins and declared that the ancient Romans must have loved animals. I conceded that they most likely regarded animals with awe while reminding her of the grueling chariot races in the Circus Maximus, the gruesome fabricated hunts in the Roman Forum, and the egregious animal slaughter that took place in the Colosseum, all for the sake of human entertainment. The ancient Romans were, like us, a diverse and complicated people. They were resourceful, intelligent, and innovative. They were also violent, ignorant, and opportunistic. In all these ways, both good and bad, we are the same. The Colosseum in Rome is a testament to this. Awe-inspiring though it was to stand inside this architectural feat and to contemplate the ingenuity, hubris, and labor that went into its design and construction, it was equally disquieting. Imagining the amount of blood shed, bodies strewn, and lives wasted over the centuries it was in use was unsettling, not only because so much unnecessary torment once took place, but mostly because it continues to. The practice of using and killing animals for our own pleasure runs throughout history and cultures. It's certainly not unique to the ancient Romans, and it did not end with them. We like to pretend that we've shed our barbaric selves, but the violent echoes of the past resound in our own amphitheaters. In modern horse racing, horses are pushed beyond their limits, only to be discarded and often slaughtered when there's little chance they'll earn a laurel crown for their riders. For our contemporary circuses, majestic wild animals are beaten into submission for the entertainment of stadium spectators. In canned hunts, animals are pursued in a confined area and then slain to be displayed as trophies. We like to believe that we're more advanced than our ancient predecessors, but when it comes to our relationship with the non-human citizens of the world, it seems that little has changed. With a perspective, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.